Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this Monday, the 20th day in September of 2021. I'm your host, Michael Kimmett, as always, bringing you four of the most crucial current events in cyber and technology that you need to make it through this, the first day of your work week. And we're going to start with an outstanding software development tool. There's a software called Travis CI that is used to develop and test programs and code. It interfaces with online code repositories like GitHub, and it's very powerful. The problem is twofold. One, it is vulnerable, and two, that vulnerability could be exploited or could have been exploited to expose your sensitive API keys, credentials, and also your access tokens, which could put your organization at risk. And the reason that this can happen is because, again, you're using public repositories, and Travis CI is open source, meaning that it's not a single vendor sort of in the traditional sense, because everyone can use their product more or less for free and manage it their own way. So it's a very complicated matter. Now, this vulnerability tracked as CVE 2021-41077 was discovered by researchers on the 7th of September, and it was fixed on the 10th of September. But from 03 to 10 September, so for roughly 7 days, this vulnerability exposed, again, your very sensitive data. Now, some people are saying move away from Travis CI because they are upset that Travis CI did not engage and reveal that this flaw existed. The good news is researchers have not found that any of these vulnerabilities were exploited, but with thousands of customers, it remains possible that if you are a Travis CI user, your data during that period may have been exposed, so it's worth double checking. It's also worth making sure that your Travis CI is up to date and that you're aware that using open source tools, or any tools really, have some inherent risks, and you need to be monitoring for updates and flaws in those products to make sure that you are not vulnerable. Moving on from vulnerable products to companies who were exploited, AT&T, the cell network and network provider giant, they also do TV and cable television. AT&T, anyways, is the victim in a case where the United States and others recently just announced huge indictments and have actually charged a Pakistani national, a man by the name of Muhammad Fahd, will spend 12 years in prison in the United States because he was the primary person responsible for a 7-year scheme that started in 2012, and this scheme involved the unlocking of iPhones. Now, this was used to conduct fraud because iPhones are worth a lot of money. And if you can steal one, that's great. But unfortunately, most cellular networks like Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile lock the phones that they offer to their own carrier network. So to have the iPhone is not very lucrative. You need to unlock it, and then you can sell it on the secondary market. Well, Muhammad Fahd was able to unlock nearly 2 million phones during an illegal scheme in which he would call initially and trick employees at a call center in Washington into doing this activity, but he also began recruiting and offering AT&T employees money to help him install malware so that he could unlock these cell phones on his own. Now, the problem here is that the cell phones would be registered to legitimate users, whether that was through fraudulent upgrades or by stealing their phone and then unlocking it. When this occurred, AT&T is claiming that individuals ceased making payments on their loaned iPhones. So this is very problematic because it's not just iPhones, it also extended to other digital devices as well, meaning that AT&T suffered nearly $200 million in losses, which Muhammad Fahd has been ordered to pay back. So the bottom line here is that there was a scheme that impacted the users of the AT&T network. The lead individual of that ring of fraudsters has been arrested, has been tried and sentenced. Unfortunately, some users are still out in the wind paying for phones or have a bill on their account for a device they no longer can use or that was stolen from them. But this is the first step in law enforcement helping prevent and show other criminals that there are severe consequences for this kind of activity. We're going to move on from fraud to banking. Interesting twist there, but there's a bank in Venezuela, Banco de Venezuela, which is the largest bank in the Venezuelan nation, and the problem they have is that they cannot service their customers. They had an unspecified cyber attack, quote, on the 15th of September, so just 5 days ago, and during these 5 days, ATMs are non-operable, mobile applications are non-operable, and transactions with the bank are non-operable. So the biggest bank in the country has not been able to process or work for its 16 million clients for over 5 days, which is an astronomical amount of time in the banking and financial world. Now, the bank has released no details on what kind of cyber attack would impact their organization for this period of time. Now, if this were a distributed denial of service or an attack that could be begun and stopped with short notice in terms of impact, it would probably be resolved by now. DDoS attacks are not necessarily easy, but fairly quickly you can recover from them. This smells like a ransomware attack, but we don't know which variant, if at all, and so it's very important that we follow up on this to find out exactly who would be impacting the Venezuelan nation, and hopefully we get some details soon, but more importantly, for those individuals who are having problems meeting their basic needs because they can't access their money, hopefully the Venezuelan bank or government help the people of that nation. So just know that if you're in Venezuela, we understand there's a very difficult time for you as you can't access your hard-earned money. And for everyone else, just know that if you rely solely on a bank for moving funds, etc., this could be something that you could face in the future. We're just going to stay on potential ransomware attacks and finish up with the President of the United States, who is debating and mulling how to address this astronomical rise in these ransomware attacks impacting organizations around the world and are threatening things like people's money, for example, or in some cases, a ransomware attack could cripple energy production or, as noted recently, affect oil pipelines, particularly in the eastern United States, meaning that gas and fuel prices could be impacted as well. So the President of the United States, Joe Biden, is expected to announce that he is going to apply sanctions against cryptocurrency exchanges, wallets, and traders that are used during these issues. So when a ransomware attack happens, most times the criminals demand cryptocurrency in some form, but banks don't, by and large, globally, process cryptocurrency, and it's not something you can just hand to another person. Therefore, you need an exchange, one of these intermediaries, these digital banks, if you will, to process the transactions. And so by targeting these vendors, it is hugely proactive. Some people are for it because it levies a certain amount of responsibility on those entities and organizations to not do business with what could be criminal activity. The flip side argues the whole point of cryptocurrency is to be anonymous, for those transactions to not be scrutinized. Now, in the case of Bitcoin, it is a public ledger. Anyone could, in theory, check any wallet, but there's not really necessarily transaction vendor IDs or those kinds of detailed elements that tell you what the money was for, just the amounts and when. And so there's some privacy issues here that people are very concerned about. Joe Biden's efforts could reduce the amount of vendors or have them very conscious about interacting with certain ransomware groups. But the flip side of that is that people who do use that vendor could have their transactions more heavily scrutinized because those vendors want to prove they are doing some basic level of scrutiny to avoid being sanctioned by the United States government. That'll do it for me today. Thank you all so very much. Have an outstanding and fantastic day. It's going to be a great week, so stay safe, stay strong, and stay healthy. We'll see you tomorrow. Until then, Michael Kimmett signing off. Ciao. Welcome back, listeners. Today's tip of the cap goes to Tani Ryan Nelb. She is getting a tip of the cap not for making history as one of the university's first classes to include women in Notre Dame in 1975, but because she was recently awarded the History Hero Award by the Historical Society of Michigan. Now, the Historical Society of Michigan, HSM, is dedicated to preserving documents and research and ensuring that the history of the local area as well as the entire state of Michigan is preserved and understood and valued and helps the people of Michigan move forward through time, not being doomed to repeat the mistakes of our predecessors. And Tani Ryan Nelb is central to that effort, writing books, archiving documents, chairing organizations dedicated to history, and so for her outstanding work and her continued persistence in this field, a sincere tip of the cap.